Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 208 it is, where the steely grip of salvation and starvation takes hold of the Amaxhosa nation by December 1856. Self-induced, a response to years of colonial expansion, encroaching land grabs, loss of power of the chiefs and ancient customs, the immediate terror of the Eighth Frontier War and its effects, a mingling of Christianity and traditional magic, an attempt at finding salvation, and a reflection on lung sickness. It was not the first nor the last millenarian movement of South African history. It was also not the only one of its type of the time in the mid-19th century. The Taiping Rebellion in China had been bludgeoning its way through the countryside, and there the number of dead would climb to more than 20 million in the decade of that country's disastrous flirtation with sectarianism and mythology. 40,000 Xhosa were going to die of starvation in British Kaffraria and what was known then as Xhosa Land. When we left off last episode, King Sarhili of the Xaleka line, the paramount chief of the Xhosa, had visited the Xhara River to meet with Mkazana and Nongqawuse, the prophet, early in 1857. A quick word about millenarian movements. Most have a particular structure and are replicated the world over. There is usually a charismatic figure. Behind this person are the administrators, the navigators, who guide this misshapen ship on its voyage, almost always towards self-destruction on the logical rocks. I studied the phenomenon in my African History Honours year with the remarkable Jeff Perez. Some examples of millenarianism other than the Taiping Rebellion, for the record, include the Munster Rebellion in Germany, which took place in 1534 and 35. When radical Anabaptists seized the city of Munster, declaring it the New Jerusalem. The Anabaptists proceeded to enforce communal property ownership and polygamy before it was shattered. How about the Sabbatean movement of the 17th century? That was when Shabbatai Tzvi claimed to be the Messiah, gathering a massive following across the Jewish world. After Ottoman authorities arrested him, he converted to Islam, shocking his followers. His sect splintered, then splintered again. In the 1830s and 40s, the Millerites of the United States predicted Christ's return in exactly 1844. Named after William Miller, the followers sold all their belongings and awaited the event, which became known as the Great Disappointment. The Millerites morphed into what we know as Seventh-day Adventists after Christ failed to pitch up in 1844. Also in the US, the ghost dance movement of the late 19th century, where the Native American prophet Wovoka preached of spiritual revival and followers believed that dance would restore their lands and bring back their dead. Eventually, this movement was crushed in the infamous US Army attack on the sect at the Battle of Wounded Knee. In 1881, Sudanese prophet Muhammad Ahmed declared himself the Mahdi, an Islamic messianic figure. He led a jihad against Egyptian and British rule with followers who believed Ahmed was going to establish divine justice, and they all began to prepare for the second coming of Jesus. His story intersected with General Charles George Gordon, an icon of British imperialism, who died in Khartoum fighting Ahmed's forces, and he was chopped up. His head was left in a tree for passers-by to lob stones at it, but Ahmed didn't enjoy his victory or the head for very long. He died 5 days later of typhus. General Kitchener got hold of his head and kept that in a jar of kerosene, apparently. The Mahdi movement splintered, but his nationalist message continues to resonate deeply in the troubled country of Sudan today. The causes of millenarianism are diverse, but the overriding similarities lie in all linked to Middle Eastern monotheistic religions, intersecting with local ancient rites and cultural norms across the globe. They are all characterized by a prophetic leader, a charismatic figure claiming divine insight. All have end times expectations. Elements of the Christian nationalist right wing in America have a similar core belief. As these baby boomers approach the end of their lives, many are convinced it's the end times for everyone. And they, of course, have anointed their own charismatic figure, who is known generally as POTUS. All millionaire-in movements emerge from a period of extreme social upheaval. All have a purification ideology, purging corruption and restoring some previous lost life. All collapse traumatically, either crushed by authorities, as in the Battle of Wounded Knee, or disband after failed predictions. When magic intersects with reality, reality eventually wins out. There were several other millenarian protest movements during the main period of European colonial expansion. There were others in Java, New Zealand, Burma, India, and Tanzania. A fever of anticipation takes hold of pilgrims of whatever monotheistic religion they belong as they approach their pilgrimage. It becomes self-fulfilling. They must see things other people claim to see, or they cannot be pure. They hear voices that only Nonkawuse of the Clara River could hear. A sensational affirmation based on those seeking conviction, wanting to believe the impossible. It is a common phenomenon of self-induced credulity at the scene of holy visitations to this day. In places like Italy and Spain, crosses weep blood, holy men cure illnesses, the lame appear to walk, if not get up and boogie. This is not to belittle belief, folks. Merely outline the continuity implicit in the human reliance on cosmology. In British Kaffiria circa 1856, government official Charles Brownlee was puzzled. "It seems absurd," he wrote, "that a shrewd and reasoning people like the Xhosa should be led astray by such reports, and that they should be giving up a certainty for an uncertainty." What really made Nonkosi's message so powerful was her claim that she actually saw the dead and spoke to them in the realm of the present. They were here, now. It wasn't the realm of the departed. The ancestors were at hand. It was this essence that caused so much excitement. People often make the grandiose statement that indigenous South Africans worship ancestors. This is incorrect. It is not worship in the Christian, Muslim, or Judaic sense. No, the ancestors are mediators between the here, the living, and the great unknown deity. The dead have gone on ahead to join with the people of the past, and the respected ancestors are very much alive in the realm of the mysterious shades who watch the living very closely. This is not Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. That's an external concept. This is an internal concept. The ancestors are spiritual translators. They are your direct family who have passed on to the other side. Nonkawuse's startling revelations that these ancestors were on the cusp of returning led to the cattle-killing frenzy. By December 1856, there had been two disappointments. The resurrection had been postponed twice. Still, the believers believed. Two harvests had passed. They did not till their land. Old people living near Peelton Mission began dying of starvation. Many others were wearing hunger belts, special girdles fastened around the stomach.
"Hunger," wrote Brownlee, "is fast closing upon its victims. And though there should be no war, their sufferings will far exceed anything which they have hitherto experienced."
Pato of the Kunukwebe sent a message to Sarili. What should he do? Death's cold hand was upon his shoulder. Maqoma, the man who'd fought so many honourable battles against the British, the greatest military commander in Xhosa history, had thrown away his good name and had led his people and his brother Nika Xhosa chiefs into this destitution. If you remember last episode, Sir George Grey, the governor, his maritime's recon mission had failed spectacularly. That HMS Giza had steamed away from Kaimal, and how the Xhosa narrative had turned this embarrassment into a victory with dead Chief Hintsa somehow resurrected and destroying the ship. Upon hearing this, Sarili ordered his counsellor Nyoka to go to Kai Mouth to collect all valuables from HMS Giza that surely must be strewn along the beach. Nyoka returned to say reports of its destruction were false. Still, the cattle killing spluttered, rumours providing the movement with power. In early January 1857, in the valley of the Mpongo River, just south of Mashweshwe's Basutu land, lived an old man, a traditional healer, a doctor called Kulwana. He was an avid believer of Nongozi's prophecies. One of his neighbours was Nongkazana, also a believer, and she had a daughter called Nongkosi, who was around 11 years old.
Nonkosi's favourite pastime was to go play in the Mpongwe River. It was summer, after all, and splashing about near a pool, she saw what she thought were strange people in the pool. A bunch of new imaginary friends. A normal childhood fantasy, but in these rarefied times of hints and allegations, there were diamonds of pure excitement for those who heard her story.
A man suddenly showed himself out of the water. I ran home, she told her mom.
Nonkosi went back to the river the next day, as had Nonkosi, who had returned to her Clara field in her original prophecy tale the previous year.
He spoke to me. He told me that I was to let Umhala and the other chiefs know about it,
claimed Nonkosi. Chief Umhala of the Amantlambi was a believer and had spent most of December 1856 killing his cattle. Nonkosi's vision stroke imaginary friend's story was grist to his mystery mill. Nonkosi said that the strange man she had met had already been to Mushweshwe and that
half Mushweshwe's people were destroyed because they were not quick in believing.
A simple fantasy, but to the people of the Amantlambi, Umhala's people, the effect was electric. Old man Kulwana, the doctor, said he believed her, and Umhala traipsed up the river to hear for himself. What a terrible indictment of one of British Kaffiria's most shrewd chiefs, a survivor of 30 years fighting the British, a venerable man, one of the richest and most powerful chiefs of the region, begging advice and guidance from an 11-year-old. He was not alone. Soon other chiefs, Patu, Kasana, Namba, all pitched up to ask this little girl what great wisdom she had to share. It is clear that the spiritual and material anguish of the Xhosa nation had pushed these men over the rational edge. Umhala in particular suffered what we'd probably call a nervous breakdown in early 1857. He rushed from homestead to homestead in a manic way, forcing his people to kill all their cattle and destroy whatever food they had. A furious abandon had seized these chiefs, certain that through purging renewal and deliverance would come. Meanwhile, a young British officer called Major John Cox Gawler was calling for reinforcements. Sent by Sir George Grey to operate as the British official overseeing Umhala's people, this youngster had stuck in Umhala's craw since he arrived in November 1855. Gawler had fought the Xhosa of Maqoma in the Amatolas in the 8th Frontier War. He was a veteran of viciousness. His job was to protect the unbelievers from those intent on instituting the total cattle killing. Part of the plan was to try and convince the unbelievers that the magical mystery tour being conducted by Umhala amounted to a form of crazy lunacy, and therefore he conducted his own less magical tour. This was of non-believer or unbeliever chiefs whom he led to Port Elizabeth, where he showed off British shipping technology as a kind of panacea to the smoke and mirrors of prophetic myth-making. Before they left on their para-religious fact-finding mission, the believers had warned the unbeliever chiefs they would be abducted and sent to England. Instead, the unbelievers returned with their own wondrous tales of large ships anchored offshore in the thriving town of Port Elizabeth. Farmers were selling bundles of wool, making money, commerce was growing. No sign of impending banishment, which Nonkosi had promised. The unbelievers began to gather together as protection, some travelling as far away as Sarhili's country across the east of the Kai River. The Mpongwe district turned into a flashpoint, and once again the landscape played its part. Deep canyons alienating the senses, darkening the spirit. Into these ravines Umhala was to send his believers to bludgeon the unbelievers. Gawler received a delegation of fearful unbelievers in February 1857. They were panicking and asked for military posts to be established. Just before sunset, on the 28th of February 1857, a war cry sounded, and believer Chief Kasana swept down on Chief Bulungwa's homestead. It was believer versus unbeliever, Xhosa versus Xhosa. Chief Bulungwa was a wicked crack shot and opened fire with his very modern musket, driving off Kasana and his attackers, but they managed to steal 60 head of cattle. Gawler complained to Umhala, demanding compensation, and Kasana should be handed over. Umhala, with tongue firmly in cheek, told his followers to go and kill him. Go and find Kasana. You are hungry, my children, but do your best. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. In March, believers smashed into other homesteads of what were now called the Amagogocha, the unbelievers, raiding their cattle. Chief Wu, a counselor and two headmen, raided the Amamfenga on the Qualeja River. On the borders of Amamtlambi territory, Patu's great son, Dimila, mustered an armed force of believers and then raided his father's unbeliever cousin, Montauli. Cometh the hour, cometh the son of the prophet Inglele, the war doctor, the man who'd led the attacks in Grahamstown in 1819. He, like his son Mjuza, was a militant anti-colonial fighter. Mjuza fought with valour in three frontier wars against the British. He was shot in the stomach during the Battle of Butterworth, but survived. Not a man to be trifled with. When Nonkosi began her tale in the Clara River in early 1856, Mjuza rushed to the scene, announcing before he left that he would return at the head of an army of black Russians to liberate the country. But it was not to be. When Mjuza met Nonkosi, he found her spiel utterly underwhelming. This son of Inglele became an unbeliever. By November 1856, he was back in Imhala's country, criticizing the venerable chief. Then in March, was attacked by the believers. This was a big mistake. Mjuza managed to rally Chief Montauli and the other isolated Amagogochas, and using classic military discipline, they outfought the believers. Mjuza hated the British, but he hated Imhala and the believers more. By now, Sir George Grey had granted Gawler's repeated requests to raise an irregular black police force. The unbelievers should live in a centralized place, he said, and a police force of up to 150 men should be set up, each paid 7 shillings and 6 pence, plus rations. Every 2 days an ox would be slaughtered, which was enough meat to feed these men. The unbelievers were not impressed. They wanted British Army regulars to come to their aid. Gawler asked for 200. Grey refused. Imhala was going to be the victim of his own conspiracy. It dawned on Gawler that this venerable chief had created a situation where revolution was the answer. Why not pay both the black police and the headmen who were appointed by a local magistrate? Thus realized perfectly Sir George Grey's own dream of a British Kaffiria free of the Xhosa chiefs. As ideas of revolution swam about in Gawler's mind, Imhala, the shrewd Amaxhosa leader, plotted the death of the British major. Alarmed by the talk of arming the unbelievers and new military posts, Imhala considered how he could kill Gawler. A show of strength took place in mid-March 1857. About 400 or 500 Amatamba, the believers, gathered in front of Gawler's magistracy, shouting angrily for 15 minutes. Then they marched off. Imhala wasn't there. Gawler summoned Imhala to appear before him on the 16th of March to account for this aggravation and accused the old Amatlambi chief of causing the cattle killing. Any future communication with the governor should also take place through him. It was well known at the time that Imhala enjoyed his brandy. He had had a shot or two before this meeting. Facing Gawler, surrounded by his supporters, Imhala lost restraint and blurted, "How is that your blood will not run with mine?" From this moment, Imhala was doomed. Some of his own chiefs approached Gawler, who had turned on his heels, and said, "Don't listen to Imhala, he's drunk now." When Imhala calmed down a few days later, it was too late, made worse by the fact that he'd also alienated the scary Mjuza, who was out to get him. Despite Mjuza's interminable battles with the British, the interminable battles with the believers appeared to be an existential threat, and Mjuza had had it with the loonies killing their own cattle. This was an opportunity not to be missed for the British. Grey authorised the establishment of a new post on the Chabo River deep in Imhala's country. From April onwards, a stream of unbelievers fled Imhala and joined Gawler and his police. The most unexpected recruit was Amatlaleka chief Sigidi. The cattle-killing frenzy was almost done. Hope flickered, because it was the only alternative to starvation or exile. More muddled prophecies emerged from the Qara and the Mpongo rivers. A new date was set for the resurrection. Now it was June 1857. Imhala, Maqoma, and Sandile plunged into renewed cattle-killing efforts. Imhala's own brother, Nowawi, couldn't take it anymore and fled to Gawler's police camp. His great son, Makinana, was an unbeliever, but had stoically stuck to his dad's side. But this renewed impetus and illogical belief in a kind of third-time lucky June 1857 resurrection was the last straw. Makinana fled to the mission station with his remaining 5 cattle. As he left, he told his father Mhala that, "I never killed of my own free will. I had hoped your eyes were open." And finally, like an epiphany, an awakening, a sense of reality returned to this respected old man. His eyes indeed opened. In June 1857, the next disappointment, no new people. The dead ancestors did not arise. The believers were starving to death in their hundreds. A terrible change had swept Anantlambe. The believers had thrown off their old chief, and therefore tradition, with contempt. Hundreds moved to the British police camp on the edge of the Chabo River. Mhala wrote a letter to the Bishop of Grahamstown, announcing he'd been fooled by the words of a girl. "Tell the governor that you have seen me, that Mhala was a great chief, but now he is fallen." During the past few months, the believers had turned into a ravenous pack, raiding the gardens of the unbelievers. They had turned themselves into highwaymen, hijackers, stalking the convoys of food and goods on the main roads in the Eastern Cape. The road between King Williamstown and East London was extremely dangerous, and Mhala and Patu had done nothing to stop these attacks. Asana's men had gone further. They had attacked and murdered a German Legion veteran of the Crimean War, Captain Olsen. That sparked full-scale riots between the Xhosa and German veterans in the port of East London. Perhaps the most famous of the believer thief gangs, Ngono was as big as a heavyweight boxer, 6'7" tall. He'd been raiding Amamfengu cattle in June 1857 when he was shot dead after being surrounded. Makoma then had a man they said was an informer killed in revenge. The rules of engagement so carefully managed by the Amakosa since antiquity were unravelling, just as the cattle killing had unravelled their minds. Gawler wanted to retaliate. Grey refused. He was afraid of causing another frontier war. But behind the scenes, the gloves did come off. Gawler was a great believer in the Shambok, including Shamboking his own men. They became known by their backs, as some said later. Across the post-apocalyptic landscape of Mhala's devastated country, Major Gawler's police galloped. It was an opportunity to rid the countryside once and for all of the Xhosa who supported Mhala. They adopted a scorched earth policy, not unlike the much feared Colonel Eyre in the final days of the Eighth Frontier War. The rampage was so bad that even British magistrates began complaining to John McLean, the local commissioner. And a missionary called Kayser tried to intervene, but it was no use. In a terrible irony, Mhala's emphatic belief in the magic of Nongqawusi's fairy tale and the utter carnage these chiefs had caused their people led to the ultimate destruction of their power in British Kaferia. The instrument through which the British would take complete control of the territory was announced by Sir George Grey in his proclamation of March the 3rd, 1857. He had arrived to personally take charge of the situation after an initial visit the previous year had ended in his collapse. This time, there would be no comeback. Here are extracts from his proclamation. "His Excellency, the High Commissioner, hereby acquaints the Xhosa chiefs that acts of robbery by armed men have recently been committed." After stating that none of the robberies were pardonable, he directed that 4 Xhosa men who were caught this morning in the Crown Reserve shall be forthwith transported. Transported meant being shipped off to Robben Island or the Cape Colony, where they'd be employed as workers, cheap labour. But there was more. "He notifies generally that all persons caught attempting to commit or having committed robberies with arms in their hands will, when convicted, be punished with death." The word death was written in uppercase. It became clear pretty quickly that the proclamation had an ulterior purpose, not to protect property so much as to force as many Amakosa to leave British Kaferia as possible. The sea voyage, the transportation, was dreaded even more than the punishment at the other side. The Xhosa population in British Kaferia dropped from an estimated 105,000 to 37,500 between January and December 1857. More than 25,000 Xhosa men and women were transported to the Cape Colony as registered workers. At least 40,000 Xhosa, as I've said, died of starvation, directly attributed to the cattle killings and the destruction of their crops. 30 years earlier, the Amamfengu refugees had arrived west of the Kai River, asking for help from the Rarabe Xhosa. Now the tables had turned. It was to the Amamfengu people that the Amaxhosa men, women and children turned in the hour of need, begging for help. Next episode, we plunge into the Zulu Civil War of 1856 and 57. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. It helps elevate its visibility. And you can head off to desmondlatham.blog. I'm going to load updates about these various episodes. You can also email me from there. Until then, diabuli sakuninonk di betakai. I greet you all. Take care at home.